Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, and I hope everyone had a wonderful Shavuot. Chag Sameach, thank you. Welcome to the second of three on... I'm going to figure out this microphone. On history's leading Philo-Semites, Philo-Semites, this week we look at Casimir the Great. This might lead a little bit into next week, depending on how long it takes us, but there's an awful lot to talk about with Casimir III, who is also known as Casimir the Great. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Polish nicknames for their kings, because they're entertaining. But we'll have to get to that. I do want to note as well that next week is Napoleon, and then after that, I'll have a four-week series called The Jew of the Future, and that is going to be also Wednesday mornings at 10, and that will be in my home base, where my Beit Midrash program is based. It's in a boys' high school, Yeshivat Or Chaim, the corner of Faywood and Almore. There is no charge. maybe what I ought to do next time is include the link for signing up on the source sheet. And that way you'll have it there, because having people register helps us plan the space for it. It's a free series. But it's called The Jew of the Future, and we'll be talking about some of the technological issues that are coming down the pike, and issues, I think one of them is, does an artificial intelligence need to observe Shabbat? Another one is going to be horoscopes, fortune-telling and predictive algorithms. One is, imagine having three Jewish mothers. Some of the issues that come up with the new fertility. It should be a fun series. So that's going to be, well, not so fun for the one with the three Jewish mothers, but we'll talk about that. But the goal, sorry?
What's the date?
It's 2 weeks from today, so that's the 26th, and then that's the first of four Wednesdays. So yeah, we can do the math. The 26th, 3rd, 10th, 17th. Got it. Okay. There we go. Sharp as a tack, this one. So the goal of our series, as we started last week, is to learn about three figures whose actions were considered beneficial for the Jews, and to look at their motivations, their impact down till today, the way that Jews viewed their conduct. And today we're going to talk about a 14th century Polish king. And his name is Casimir, as we'll see. We'll talk about what motivated him to take steps that really benefited the Jews of his day. We'll look at the religious and social controversies surrounding the story of his Jewish girlfriend, and how that king's help for the Jews has actually influenced Polish-Jewish relations down to today. And I found quite a few very helpful papers and books on this. One in particular is very interesting. It's called Poland and Polin, New Interpretations in Polish-Jewish Studies. Polin being the name that Jews classically used for Poland. But we'll talk about the significance of that name towards the end. But what I want to start with is a basic question, which is, what is the truth about Polish-Jewish relations? Meaning, if you ask anybody post the 1940s, we know exactly what the truth is about Polish-Jewish relations. But historically, over time, because the fact of the matter is, for reasons that we're going to talk about, if you go back to the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th century, you find that Poland becomes a haven for Jews. Jews who are first running away from the Crusades, then running away from the Inquisition, then running away from Germany in the 16th century. Jews end up in Poland, so much so that Poland becomes known as, and there's a term we're going to use shortly in one of the sources, a paradise for Jews. And so the question is, how do we view that? How do we look at the relations between the Jews and the Poles? If you take a look at source number one, you find a popular view stated by Shai Agnon in an article called Kidumot. Kidumot would mean what? What would Kidumot mean? Sorry? Not previews exactly. No, that which once was, that which happened in the past. Right, that which, the history, you could say history, I suppose. And the translation is by Chava Bar Yitzchak. I didn't actually see the original Hebrew on this. He says, they, meaning the Jews, went to the land of Poland and gave the king a mountain of gold. the king received them with great honor. The Lord had mercy on them and caused the king and ministers to show mercy to them. The king allowed them to settle in all the lands of his kingdom and to worship the Lord according to the tenets of their religion. The king protected them against any foe and adversary. In other words, it was an exchange. Right? We gave the king money, and therefore the king allowed us to stay and took care of us. Meaning, it wasn't really a good place for us, but as long as we were able to pay them, they would allow us to live there. And that's certainly one view, and we're going to talk more about the substance behind that view in a little bit. But it's not what the Poles think. If you take a look at source number 2, Museum of the History of Polish Jews, and there you have the Latin name Paradisus, Eudorium, the paradise for the Jews. During this period, this is from the museum itself. This is the museum's own blurb describing one of their exhibits about the period in Jewish history in Poland, you see 1569 to 1648. During this period, Jews enjoyed a high degree of autonomy. They had their own self-government, including the Council of Four Lands, called Wad Arba Arotzot, a phenomenon unique in Europe. Unlike in other countries, they experienced no mass religious persecution. On the contrary, they could develop their learning, print books, sometimes even debate with Christian intellectuals. It is precisely at this time that prominent authorities on Jewish religious law lived and wrote in the town of Kazimierz, which is a town that we'll talk about more, near Krakow, at the very heart of an influential Jewish community. The famous rabbi and thinker, Moses Israelis, known as Rama, wrote the Mapa, a collection of customs and religious precepts for Ashkenazi Jews. The second half of the 16th century brought yet another change. Encouraged by the nobility, Jews began to settle on vast noble estates in the east of the country. They engaged in new activities, leasing inns, mills, and breweries, trading in grain and cattle. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? The Museum of the History of Polish Jews thinks that that was actually a wonderful time and that everything was great. Because there were no other times when we had the chance to debate with Christian intellectuals about religion. No, I wouldn't view the forced debates, you know, of the 13th century and 14th century in Spain as anything like that. There were all sorts of debates with Christian intellectuals over time. Encouraged by the nobility, we were able to do all sorts of things, to lease inns, mills, brewery, trading grain and cattle. It really sounds wonderful. It sounds like we should just pick up and move there. But that's their view. And in particular, that's the view of the museum. This remarkable article, which I quote for you in source number 3, The Embassy of Poland in Poland, The Poland Myth in the Museum of the History of Polish Jews as Narrative Pattern and Model of Minority-Majority Relations, is a fascinating article. She goes through this Polish museum and describes, I didn't give you obviously the full article, it's a long article, you can find it online, but she gives you an account of the exhibits, and not just the exhibits, but the comments that the docents make about what Jewish life was like. And the narrative is, it was great. That was where you wanted to be. If you take a look at number 3, here she describes something contemporary. She's talking about memorials for the Warsaw Ghetto. And she writes, "For years, the only symbolic center in this place with no name was the 1948 monument to the fighters and martyrs of the ghetto, designed by Natan Rappaport, Leonora X. Susan. Facing the monument now stands the 2013 Poland Museum of the History of Polish Jews, designed by Rainer, I'm not sure how to pronounce the next name, Machlameki, I don't know. But there are also 10 other additional memorials. They encircle the monument and the museum. 3 of them are devoted to the ghetto uprising. 1 identifies the Germans as the perpetrators of the Holocaust. 6 emphasize efforts by both Polish society and the Polish underground state to help the Jews, at the risk of the helper's own lives, without any other mention of the context. The message emanating from the content, as well as the proportion of commemorations, is clear. Polish solidarity with the Jews was a fact, and it stood the test of terror and death brought about by the Germans. They were on our side, they were trying to help us, they were fighting the Germans, and so forth." The last source I'm going to bring in this little introduction, but from source number 4, is about the museum itself. Jumping back in time from the 20th century to earlier times. The exhibition's guides and their stories are among the keys to introducing some order into this chaos. meaning before that she describes how there are various terms that are thrown around, how they talk about the Jews, but not in a structured way. And then you get the guides and their stories to sort of explain. One can learn from them, for instance, that in the Middle Ages, there were less than 1% of Jews in Poland, but they stood out and had connections with the rulers. That, quote, the Jews were identified by pointy hats. Right, that's also known as the garb that Jews had to wear, right, in Catholic Europe. Also in Muslim, you know, Southern Europe, but that's a separate point. That King Casimir was kind to the Jews because he had a Jewish mistress, Esterka. We're going to talk about that one. That the synagogues in eastern Poland, shtetls, quote, burned down spontaneously due to lightning strikes or arson. I don't know what that means. Spontaneous arson. There's something wrong with that phrase. I know there is. Maybe it's spontaneously due to lightning strikes, comma, or I don't know. That in general, the hierarchs of the Catholic Church and kings opposed the persecution of Jews, but they were not always able to do so effectively. That, quote, Polish-Jewish relations developed somehow, the Jews working as servants to the Christians and the other way around. So who's telling the truth? Right? Which account? I mean, I could read all of this, and I could go to the museum, and there's a lot of material online about the museum for those who aren't actually going to Poland, which is a whole other conversation, the question of going there. But you can see the exhibits online. You can see quite a bit's been written about them. You can look through all of that material and think, okay, this really was a grand place for Jews historically, going back to the 16th century period that's described in source number 2, that things were great and that persisted all the way through World War II, such that the Poles tried to help the Jews in World War II, and everything would have been fine and dandy except for the Germans. That's one view. And then you have Agnon's view, which we saw in number 1, which is certainly a lot more cynical about it, and says, no, actually we had to pay in order to be there, and it was only, you know, a matter of you can stay as long as you can line the pockets of the king with gold. I mean, yeah, I'm coming into this as second generation after survivors, and so look, that's what shapes my view of Poland. And it's not the account of the Polish government about how, you know, they did everything they could to save us. But what's your perspective? Based on what you've seen and based on what you know, perhaps from your travels, what would you say about the conflict between these two perspectives on Jewish life in Poland? Susan?
Well, even today, like what's going on in Poland now with the war memorials and everything, and they're denying...
We're going to get to that.
So they changed... Today, we see them doing the same thing, changing the history to fit the model they want. So who's to say that this is not a pattern from, because we're viewing it, it can't come from nowhere.
So Susan is viewing this as part of what is seen today. I mentioned it briefly last week, and we're going to see a lot more about it before we're done, about the whole dust-up in the past year, where there was supposed to be this conference that would go on in Israel, and the leadership of Poland was going to show up to it, and then Netanyahu made comments to the Times of Israel that talked about Polish guilt for the Holocaust, and then they said, well, we're not coming if that's what you say happened, because actually we were the good guys. So maybe that's part of this. There's more to be said about where that thought process comes from. I will tell you right now that I don't believe that it's entirely disingenuous. I don't think that it's entirely a group of people trying to rewrite history. I think there's a genuine trend, which we're going to see, in Polish thought, in which they believed themselves for a very long time to be benevolent. And we'll talk about where it comes from, what created it, and the different sides of that story and the different perspectives on it that go way back. These aren't new. This goes back 600 years. Sylvia, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm also a second generation. My parents were born in Poland, lost their family. My father said the Poles hated us, period.
And that's certainly what I've heard. Sylvia says, what her father said, she's a second generation, was the Poles hated us, period. That was the narrative. Yes, and then yes.
That's what I believe also. When my father, he fought in the Polish army, and when the Germans, they were the Polish army clan, when the Germans were coming, the Polish soldiers, and he was fighting for Poland, said, now you dirty Jews, the Germans will get you. Mm-hmm. So I will never go to Poland.
Right. So the account is of a Jew fighting in the Polish army, fighting on their side. and then having his fellow soldiers turn on him when the Germans came in, saying, now the Germans are going to get you. Yes?
When my father was 9, leaving Poland with my grandmother, on the train through Poland, kept hearing dirty Jews go to Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Same account, right? The insults, the attacks, the threats. I mean, that's certainly what I grew up hearing about. Yes.
I'm on the other side, and I feel very funny even bringing this up. My father's family left in 1934, and we have his sisters who were 19 and 20 at the time talking about Poland. Like it was wonderful. Their neighbors were fabulous to them. And my mother, who was born in Canada, said her mother-in-law, who was Polish, through the whole war felt that their neighbors and business partners would have saved them. And it's so hard for us to listen to them.
Right.
They talk about how wealthy they were and how things were good. And when they came to Canada, they couldn't go to school. They had to go to work. And
So the whole family got out in 1934.
The whole family.
So if things were going well, why did they leave in 1934?
Because they had one member of the family who left in 1920, the oldest sister. Uh-huh. And she started bringing everybody over. And the folklore of the family is that my eldest aunt's mother-in-law saw the writing on the wall and said, you get everybody out, we start bringing everybody. So people started coming one at a time, and in 1934, mm-hmm. 5 of them left for Canada and 1 went to Israel.
So it's really important to hear this, right? Because even though what everybody else has said is certainly what I heard growing up, you can't deny, number one, that there were stories of people who did endanger themselves, Christians who did endanger themselves to save Jews. And that here you have somebody who's saying, this was our family experience. Granted, they left in 1934, so it wasn't put to the test. But the experience was of neighbors who they believed would have been on their side. I see a lot more hands. I worry that I'm opening up a Pandora's box that is not going to close. So I'm going to actually just suggest that we go a little further, recognizing that I would guess if we took all of the hands, probably the weight of the testimonials would be vast majority on the side of what we heard first, and maybe one or two more who would be on the side of, no, we actually, did okay. Well, I want to talk about Casimir the Great now. I only called him Casimir the Third on the top of the sheet, not in order to take away from the fact that they call him in Poland Casimir the Great. He actually was pretty good for us, but because last week we had Cyrus the Second, who was also Cyrus the Great, and I didn't want confusion between the two greats. They're not related as far as I know. But before we talk about Casimir himself, we have to give a little bit of history. And you have to go back to the year 1264. 1264, and I gave you actually a little bit of a timeline here in source number 5 rather than give you a lot of material to read about the history of Poland. So I'm actually going to work from the timeline that I have, that I put there. That may work better. The 10th century is the start of the Polish monarchy. Begins a dynasty called the Piast dynasty, and that continues until Casimir. He's actually the last one in that dynasty. He ends up passing the monarchy to his nephew, Louis of Hungary, but the dynasty runs from the 10th century until Casimir. Very important to know about is that in the 13th century, the Mongols invade Europe, and that includes an invasion of Poland. At first, they're not interested in Poland. At first, they're actually interested in Hungary. And the invasion of Poland is intended as a distraction in order to prevent forces from coming to the aid of the Hungarians. That was the initial move. But then they end up devastating Poland as well. Then you get to the year 1264. In the year 1264, there is a king, Boleslav II. Actually, he's not a king. Boleslav II, the pious, that's his adjective, P-I-O-U-S. Actually, I wrote it on the sheet. Never mind. So he is the Duke of Greater Poland. And the reason why it's called Greater Poland is because Poland at that point is in pieces. And the region that he was the duke of, his duchy, was Greater Poland. And he issued a decree giving great rights compared to what else was going on at the time, to the Jews. And we'll talk about the specific rites a little bit later on. You'll see a little bit about it in number 9. We'll get to it. The Statute of Kalish is what it was called. But that's really a landmark when he agrees to do that. We'll talk about why he did it. We'll get there. But that's a very important piece in terms of setting the stage. In the beginning of the 14th century, there's a king by the name of Boleslav. This is Boleslav III. He was actually called Boleslav III of the Wrymouth, as you see written there. Wrymouth because of some kind of a quirk in his mouth, like it looked like he was smirking. So that was what he was called. And he had four sons. And in order to keep his four sons from quarreling after his death, he divided up Poland into five provinces. And he gave two to the eldest, double portion for the eldest, and then one to each of the others. So what ends up happening is that Poland is broken up into separate units, and of course, you know, the result of this is not going to be to make peace between them, just the opposite. Now there is fighting between them as they all want to unite Poland under their own name. So that didn't quite work out as planned. Poland at that point is also weaker than it had been because of those invasions that I mentioned. And that leads to a fellow by the name of Vladislav I, the Elbow High. That's his name that he got. Can you guess why he was known as the Elbow High? Yes, he was short. The other versions of it are the Span High, the L High. The problem is you're translating from the Polish, but it's all basically the same. He was short. If you're interested, actually, if you flip the page to source number 8, you have a website that comes from Poland itself, from the Polish government, with weird names for Polish monarchs. So if you want to look that up, you can do that. They had all sorts of odd names, and it seems like it was just popularly given. There wasn't an office of the nicknames, which chose the name that the king or the duke was going to be known as. It just happened, but they all have them. They all have nicknames, and some are stranger than others. In any case, Vladislav I, the Elbow High, was a duke. He's part of this dynasty. And in the year 1305, he gained a lot of territory from these different provinces, and ultimately, with the approval of the Pope, he became king. He was supported by various dukes, and he fought quite a few wars. He built alliances. Things didn't quite work out so well. There was a fellow named John of Bohemia who contended that he was supposed to be the king, and he invaded, and there was a war. I don't want to get too bogged down in that because it doesn't really relate so much to where we're going. But he is the king until the year 1333 when he passes away, and his son is Casimir III. So Casimir comes into a Poland which has been split into different territories, all fighting with each other to become what will be recognized ultimately as Poland. It is a nation that has been somewhat depopulated because of the Mongol invasions, hasn't been particularly well run. That's been sort of ebb and flow in terms of things. He's born in the year 1310, lives until the year 1370. As I said, he becomes king in 1333. I gave you a portrait on the sheet. If you look at number 7 there, I noted there, this portrait, well, first of all, it's in a black and white copy of, actually, do you have black and white or color? Did the office do color? No, black and white. Okay, so you don't get the full benefit of it, but also note that it's 19th century, and therefore I'm not really sure what he was drawing from. I did see a seal of his online, and in the seal he's clean-shaven, so I'm not sure what to make of that. But this is an official Polish portrait of Casimir III. In any case, he is the only Polish king to be given the title of the Great. He was known, in a nutshell, for being just and fair. He had a mind for administration and leadership, much more of a diplomat than a warrior, but he went to war when he needed to do so. Family life was a bit of a problem for him, and we're going to have to circle back to that. In the year 1325, he marries a woman by the name of Aldona, who was the daughter of the Duke of Lithuania. That was a political marriage. It came with liberation of thousands of Polish prisoners of war who had been lost in the, or captured, I should say, in the previous reign. He had two daughters with Aldona. Aldona died. Then he was engaged to another woman, broke that off, engaged to another woman, broke that off. Married a woman by the name of Adelheid of Hesse until the year 1356 when he declared himself divorced. Remember, Poland is Catholic at this point. So declaring himself divorced is another way to say he abandoned her. Then he married his mistress, Christina of Prague. Adelheid complained to the Pope, who rebuked Casimir, who said, "That's very nice." In 1365, he married another woman. His previous wife was still alive. Her name was Jadwiga. His will actually mentions children from another woman by the name of Kudna. With all of this, he does not produce a male heir, and that's what leads to his government going to his nephew, Louis I of Hungary. But that's in terms of the family life, and as I said, we're going to have to come back to it because it's relevant. But in terms of the territory, he makes a peace deal with John of Bohemia, and he gives him Silesia in exchange for recognition of Casimir and the rest of Poland. But then he has a problem because they need land. And so to compensate for that, he goes to war and he annexes Galicia as well as Red Russia. So he more than doubles Polish territory in his time. I thought about bringing a map, but honestly, every time I look at these maps of Poland and what was where and when, it gives me such a headache. So you can look online and try to sort it out yourself if you wish. But it doesn't relate much to where we're going. So again, I didn't feel like it was the essence. His major achievements were domestic. He built up the population after those Mongol invasions. First of all, he invites in a range of nationalities. He invites in Saxons, Moravians, the Dutch, and yes, the Jews. He issues a call and says, "You should come here. We need people." In particular, he fights for the rights of peasants. He becomes known in some texts as the peasant king or the king of the peasants. He was considered to be somebody who supported them against the nobles in part of his establishment of the rule of law. He was very into construction. He chartered hundreds of new towns. There was something called the Magdeburg Law. It was a system of municipal administration that was established in Magdeburg, Germany. And he imported the system and applied it in these towns that he created. He also built walls to protect the towns. He built dozens of castles. And he specifically built in brick and stone. He said, "Well, the Mongols invaded and they destroyed everything we had. They burned things down. Let's try building with brick and stone." So there's a popular Polish saying. I wrote it for you in number 8, that the second bullet point. If anybody here knows Polish, they can read it. I'm going to give you the English translation. He found a Poland made of wood and he left it made of stone. That was what they used to say about him. He was very big on administration. He recognized the internal governments of the of towns within Poland, and he reorganized them. He created civil and commercial laws as well as courts to administer them. He wanted to have one code of law that would ultimately govern the affairs of Poland. He did not succeed in getting that everywhere, but that was one of his goals. In 1364, he founded a university in Krakow. It is one of the oldest universities in Europe. It still exists. And it's certainly the oldest in Poland. And his goal was to educate administrators and lawyers, people who would be able to run all of these towns and administer the system that he was trying to create. He created a new silver coin. It's called a grosz. You've probably heard of it. He started that as a means of trying to enable trade. You may not like Poland, but you listen to this and you hear, this is a king who seems to know what he's doing, at least in terms of his public life, if not in terms of his private life. He also defends Poland from the Black Death. Right? Remember, the Black Death is smack in the middle of his reign, 1346 to 1353. So Poland only loses 25% of their population to the Black Death. Remember that estimates throughout Europe range 30% to 60%. Of the population. So they actually did better than others, and there are all sorts of reasons that are suggested. This is fascinating epidemiology, the question of why it is that they did better than others. One suggestion I've seen was that there was a lack of rats, which may have been climate related. Another suggestion I've seen is because it was off of the major trade routes. and therefore you just didn't have people traveling through who would be able to transmit it. Very interesting argument is that the distance between towns in Poland was such that there wouldn't be enough time for people to get from point A to point B if they already had the disease. So in other words, they leave a city on their way to the next town, they're dead, they don't make it. So the incubation period is too short for them to be able to make it from one town to another. But one particular point is interesting. He instituted a quarantine at the borders. One of the first in history, recognizing that the disease was being communicated, he said, okay, so let's hold people up at the border for periods of time, and that way we'll be able to figure out who has it and prevent the spread. That's a little bit about Casimir III in general. Questions on that before we talk about him and the Jews? Okay. So, the Jews were in Poland well before the time of Casimir III, at least the 10th century, if not earlier. We mentioned before that Boleslav the Pious gives the Jews certain rights under the Statute of Kalish in the year 1264. In source number 9, I gave you a translation of some of the rules that were in the Statute of Kalish. I was aided in two ways. I found the website, which you see there, which actually has the Polish version of it. However, my Polish is non-existent. So I used Google Translate, and that helped somewhat. And then I looked at the work of Simon Dubnow in History of the Jews in Russia and Poland, where he brings a record of some of the rights that they had and used that to reconstruct the clauses that I included here. So take a look at number 9. This is not Casimir. This is before him. When there is a case against a Jew, a Christian cannot stand against him alone but with another Jew. Stand against him means as a witness. In other words, until you get to the time of Boleslav, you could have a case in which there is a charge by a Christian against a Jew, the Christian testifies, and it's accepted, and that's that. Now, he had to have a Jew as part of his case testifying against the other Jew, because it was recognized that things were biased, and that Jews were being taken advantage of. When a Christian pleads for a pledge by a Jew, right, a collateral that had been given, and the Jew asserts that he didn't take any, the Jew says, I lent you money and I didn't take a collateral from you, then the Jews will swear and go free. So they have to swear that this is true, they have to take an oath, but then they'll be believed. Jews in their disputes, meaning disputes among themselves, are excluded from the municipal courts. They're under the protection of the king or military commander. In other words, it's not autonomous. We aren't able to run our own society. However, there was a system of courts to adjudicate affairs between Jews, and it was actually governed by somebody who was known as the judge of the Jews, who was himself a Christian appointed by the government. But at least he's working within the Jewish community. It was at a location that would be convenient for the Jewish community, and hopefully, you know, took under advisement the rules that the Jews had for themselves. For wounding a Jew, just punishment and the cost of treatment. So in other words, you wound a Jew, you actually have to pay for treatment and you get punished for it. Yes, this was a novelty. For killing a Jew, just punishment and confiscation of property. A Christian who destroys the cemetery, in addition to ordinary punishment, loses money. So punishment for vandalizing a Jewish cemetery. Someone should mention that to the Poles. For a rape committed against a Jew, a Christian will be punished according to the laws of the land. The baptism of a Jewish child as a theft will be considered, because this was something that was quite familiar back in the day, kidnapping and baptizing Jewish children. Jews must not be accused of using Christian blood. It's against the blood libels. It is free for Jews to buy all the goods, bread, and other foods to touch. Jews are allowed to buy goods. Yes, someone needed to say that. So again, there's sort of a contrast, because you look at this and say, what kind of world were Jews living in before 1264? But on the other hand, you look at it and say, well, you know what? At least somebody came along and said this is wrong. He allowed Jews to live where they chose. They no longer need to live in particular areas as well. What is this all about? Generally, it's understood that Jews were involved in helping to finance the government. They provided capital, and as a result, the government felt it's appropriate that we give them the ability to function, to run their affairs, and to live without being constantly under attack. It's not assumed that this was, I'm a nice guy, and I've decided that this should be done. Really, we could have done a separate class on Boleslav the Pious and looked more at him, but I chose Casimir, and that's who we're going to work with. But running a generation later, in the very beginning of the 14th century, there's a Jewish man by the name of Jordan, who was a great banker for the Polish monarchy and the nobles at that period, the start of the 14th century, and he becomes very important. During the time at that start of the 14th century, the Jewish population increases in large numbers with immigration from the West. There were a couple of major massacres in the area of Germany at that time. The name Rindfleisch ring a bell. People are familiar with that. That was location of one. Armleder was another. As well as Jews fleeing pogroms in the period of the Black Death when you move to the middle of the 14th century. And so Jews from Germany migrate east. I did find a contrarian view, because there's always a contrarian view, which argues that, no, there wasn't really much of a shift. It's not really true, but it's a very small minority voice. In it, pretty much everybody seems to agree that there's a major flow of Jews into Poland, running from the beginning of the 14th century and running through the century in the time of Casimir. In the year 1334, 1 year into his monarchy, Casimir reaffirms the rights of Jews. He reaffirms the statute of Kalish, and he expands it. If you take a look at source number 10, this is from Simon Dubnov, from the History of the Jews in Russia and Poland. He says, the Polish lawgiver, he's talking about Casimir, was equally solicitous about enforcing respect for the Jew as a human being and drawing him nearer to the Christian in private life, in violent contradiction with the tendency of the church to isolate the infidels from the, quote, flock of the faithful. If the Jew, runs one of the clauses of Casimir's charter, enters the house of a Christian, no one has a right to cause him any injury or unpleasantness. Which, again, someone had to say that. but someone did. The fact that he said it is something. And then, next paragraph in number 10, Casimir was equally interested in ordering the inner life of the Jews, meaning the way Jews relate to each other. The Jewish judge is what I had mentioned before. A Christian official appointed by the king to try Jewish cases was enjoined to dispense justice in the synagogue or some other place in accordance with the wishes of the representatives of the Jewish community. The role of process server was assigned to the schoolman, which is also the shamash, synagogue beadle. This was the germ of the future system of kahal autonomy, the idea that Jews are self-governed. He applied the Magdeburg Law, which I had mentioned earlier, the one that came from Germany, to a city which is known sometimes as Lemberg and sometimes as Lvov, and gave Jews autonomy in Lvov. I found a fascinating article, and in source number 11, it's on age.com, and I have to be honest, my assumption when I go to age.com is not that I'm going to find some well-researched scholarly article. That's not their style usually. But this actually was very, very well done. It's by Professor Pearl Herzog. And look what she reports in number 11. In 1347, the Jews were accused of having murdered a child who was found in a forest not far from Krakow. The king conducted a public investigation, and through his chancellor, Jacob of Melchtin, and the priest Prandola, who was also favorably disposed towards the Jews, the innocence of the Jewish people was proven. Thereafter, King Casimir promulgated an edict refuting the blood libel, as well as defining the punishment for a charge not substantiated by proofs. In other words, if you make a charge and it's not proved, you're in trouble. A year later, King Casimir once again protected the Jewish people, this time from attacks by anti-Semitic mobs who falsely accused the Jews of poisoning the wells after an outbreak of the Black Plague. There's also this very bizarre story. I didn't bring it on here. It appears on the Hebrew Wikipedia page about Casimir. And I didn't see a source for it that I would respect, so I didn't bother to translate it on the sheet, but I'll tell you the story, because it's a classic Jewish story. The story goes that Casimir instituted a rule that at every synagogue in Poland, you had to have a portrait of the king hanging at the entrance, that people would bow to the portrait of the king when they entered. Well, the Jews didn't do it because we don't bow to the portraits of the king. And he goes to visit one Saturday morning. He goes to visit the big synagogue in Kazimierz, was a neighborhood that had been part of Krakow. And it actually was a neighborhood with many Jews in it. So he goes to visit the big synagogue there, and of course the portrait's not there. And he says, "What happened? Where's my portrait?" And the rabbi thinks fast. And he says, "Well, you know, every day Jews put on tefillin, right? Put on phylacteries, but on Shabbat, on Saturdays, we don't put it on. The reason why we don't put them on Saturdays is because they are supposed to be a reminder that God is with us, a sign that God is present with us. But on Saturday, God is here. It's Shabbat, and therefore we don't need the tefillin." So he says, the same thing is true for your portrait. Every day we need to have the portrait here as a reminder. But if you come for a visit, who needs a portrait? We have the real thing. It's such a classic Jewish story. But I have no indication that this story is true. But in any case, the Casimir's legacy for the Jews lasts long beyond his time. His successor, Louis I of Hungary, was not good. He was a problem. He was a problem for the Jews. But the rights that Casimir III gives the Jews in his day are reaffirmed by Casimir IV in 1453, and then by King Sigismund I in 1539. That same king establishes the first Jewish knight who was not required to leave Judaism to become a knight. It sounds a little bit odd. To have a Jewish knight, given the relationship between the knights and the Jews, over time. Nonetheless, that was the case. He also abolished the requirement of the Jewish badge. The Jewish Virtual Library, which is a very interesting website with quite a bit in terms of resource material, has an article claiming that by the 16th century, 80% of world Jewry is living in Poland. I have a very hard time with that number, just knowing the volume of Sephardic Jewry. I can't believe that number is actually correct. But I mention it because, wow, that's really a statement. So, based on everything we've seen, based on what we've now heard in my quick digest of Casimir's career and his relations with the Jews, what would you assume were the motivations for his help towards the Jews?
Money.
I hear money.
Yeah.
Finance. That's... So, there were times when Jews had that role. We're talking about one in particular you may be thinking of. Yeah?
Rabbi, if Casimir was the man who inherited Poland made of wood and then used stone.
Yes.
It costs money. Mm-hmm. And he has to have a sophisticated system in order to finance.
Right, and this is definitely one argument, is that the money was needed not only because he wanted money for himself, but that his activities needed the support of people who could actually finance it. Yes? You were going to say? Okay. Yeah?
I think that Poland being such a Catholic country even then, it was kind of a little bit of a... against the monarchy, and the monarch to be able to become stronger has to have.
Interesting. So there is a battle that goes on, and we find this in various countries in Europe during this period, between the church on the one hand and the monarchs on the other. And the Jews were very often the ones in between, because the monarchs wanted the Jews to be in their land. They wanted the capital, and it helped to build up their power base. And the church would say, well, you can't do that. And the monarch would say, yes, I can. And it would go back and forth, different countries at different times. So yes, there's a certain degree of not only taking advantage of the capital they provided, but actually using it in, as leverage in that seesaw. Absolutely. Senator, you were going to say?
Yeah. Well, they were tenacious and hardworking.
Mm-hmm.
And studious.
Well, I'm not sure what we're transplanting from one generation to another. I'm not sure I would make all the assumptions that of those traits. But clearly, one piece of this is that Jews would be good for Poland's growth. Good for the growth, first of all, in terms of immigration. Remember, we said he's trying to build up the population. He wants people to move there. Jews, number one, are looking for places to go, and number two, had a high birth rate. right? So in terms of building up your population, you do well when you bring in the Jews. That's number one. Number two, we were well suited for his agenda in terms of replenishing the towns. He's not looking for farmers. He wants people who are urban, who live in the cities. Jews who have been denied the ability to own land for so long are an urban population. So it fits really well to bring us there. And so in terms of Poland's growth, we'd be good for that. Also, money for his activities. I mentioned Jordan before, who in the period right before Casimir III is very active in lending money to the government. So Jordan has a son whose name is Levko. And he provides banking help for all of the construction and military ventures. He also managed and financed the mint. And I don't know if that was what you were thinking of, Bernie, before. He manages the mint, and he's also manages the royal salt mines, which, of course, are a major money-making operation. So there's a lot of material about Levko online, but I'm not going to really go into him right now. I did mention in source number 12, I brought you the article on Levko from the Yavo Encyclopedia of Jews in Eastern Europe. So you see a little bit about him there. Levko was the most important financial backer to serve Polish kings during the second half of the 14th century. Coming from Krakow, he was the son of Yardane and, I don't know, Kashitsa? Is that right? Kashitsa, I don't know. Was married to Zwanka and was the father of Abraham, Kinaan, Yisrael, Yardane, and Golda. I don't know how you end up with that fifth name after the first four. Right? You have these very biblical names associated with the land of Israel and Golda. I don't know. A member of a council convened by Casimir the Great in 1368 to discuss the organization of salt mines, Levko became the co-lessee of such mines, and that tells you something as well. In other words, it wasn't just being a manager, it was also that you're paying something to rent the running of the mine. He also helped administer the royal mint, as I mentioned there. So that's a second piece of it. But the third piece, and the most fascinating one, and the one that's going to drive everything else we have to say about Casimir, is the story of Esterka. We have already alluded to her in one of the sources that we read. So the earliest written record of this story comes not from a Jewish source, but from a Polish source. A priest by the name of Jan Dlugosz. And it comes from his chronicles, the annals, namely the chronicles of the famous Congress Kingdom of Poland, which is quite the name. We're going to talk about this fellow Dlugosz a little bit more, but I want to get you the story first. He says, and he is writing 75 to 100 years after the time of Casimir, which is important, of course, because when something first appears in writing, a couple of generations afterwards, you start to wonder about its authenticity. But this is the story that he tells as brought in a translation. King Casimir took for himself a concubine, because his family life wasn't chaotic enough. A concubine, Esther, of Jewish origins, because of her extraordinary beauty. Also, at the request of the above-mentioned Esther, he granted all Jews living in the Congress Kingdom of Poland extraordinary privileges and freedoms, which greatly offended God's Majesty. Suspicions were raised that this document was forged by certain people. Interesting. Yeah, doesn't it? Right? Esther, right? Jewish woman becomes the concubine of the king. Esther is the wife of the king, but manages to get him to spare the Jews from all sorts of trouble. So the first Jewish version of it is also 16th century Poland. Rabbi David Gans, who was an interesting figure. He was a student of two of the leading sages of the day, the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who was mentioned before, and the Maharal of Prague, who people may know of as the reported creator of the golem, although he did not create a golem, but that's what everybody says. Fine, go up to the attic of the old Mishul. But take a look at number 14, where it's very clear that they're working from the same source. They're almost word for word the same. Casimir is king of Poland. I did the translation from the Hebrew here. Casimir, king of Poland, took for a concubine a Jewish girl named Esther, a bitula, could be virgin, could be young woman, of beautiful appearance, the likes of whom was not found in the entire land. She was his wife for many days, and for her the king benefited the Jews with great benefits. She sought from the king for the Jews texts of generosity and liberation. This is part of a work. I should explain what this comes from. His work is a history book, essentially, of the lives of the Jews, and he goes year by year and presents things that roughly relate to that year. So this is his entry for 1370, which is the year that Casimir passes away. This story is a really loaded story. It is, as I put in the heading on the sheet, right above number 15, a microcosm of the conflicted relationship between the Poles and the Jews. Interestingly, this is not the only post-Esther story. In other words, Esther-style story involving a Jewish woman who has influence with a non-Jewish ruler. Alfonso VIII of 12th century Castile had a Jewish mistress, and that's actually verified in the historical record. Emperor Ivan Alexander of 14th century Bulgaria had a second wife by the name of Sarah, who was reported to have been Jewish, although I believe she converted it. I believe that she actually converts to Christianity. But what would you say, before we see any of the literature about this story and the analysis and so on, real or fake? Real? Yeah.
And even after today, I come from Egypt originally, and we know for a fact that there were some very high, prominent Egyptian ministers who got involved with Jewish dancers and whatever. They had even to recall.
Okay, so the argument is that this things like this happened elsewhere, Egypt as an example. Well, that's the idea, is that it sounds a lot like Purim. But it's not quite, and there are a few important differences between them which we're going to have to talk about, but it sounds almost too much like Purim, right? It sounds like somebody wanted to write a Purim story, essentially. You call her Esther, how on the nose do you get? Yes?
Are there any children?
So there were children, as the story is told. We'll get to it in one of the sources below. But there are sons and there are daughters. Clearly the sons cannot be raised as an heir to the throne because they're Jewish and they're from this concubine. The daughters are actually raised Jewish, as the story goes. The boys are not. So yes, they are supposed to have been children related to this. So Jews loved this story at the time, and they built all sorts of stories on top of this story. I found a doctorate by a woman by the name of Rina Havlin, and she brought quite a few stories that related to this. So, for example, you had the town of Radom in Poland, and there were Jews there who claimed that their city's name came from a term in Polish, meaning he was happy with these houses, because they alleged that Casimir had built up their neighborhood as a place for Esterka to live, and that he built a palace for her, and he built houses, that there could be a little Jewish community around her, and so they took Radom as Radom, and that meant he was happy with these houses. In Lublin, there's a story that she was buried in the old Lublin cemetery with a headstone saying, "Here lies a woman who was born to a Jewish tailor and became a simple tailor and became a Jewish queen." There's actually a custom in Warsaw tied to Esterka, recorded in books from a couple of centuries ago, that on Simchat Torah they would dance, instead of going around seven times, seven hakafos, they would dance three and a half, and then they would recite slichot, prayers to God for forgiveness, and it related to a visit by King Casimir and problems that developed. There are all sorts of places which have associations, they claim, with the story of Esterka. It's also found, the story is found, not only in Jan Dlugosz's writing, but it's found in other Polish writing down through the ages. So if you take a look at number 16, 15 was a link to an article that talks about other Esters in our history. But this is a very important book in terms of studying the Esterka story. Professor Choni Shmeruk was a professor of Yiddish literature at Hebrew U. And he wrote a book called The Esterka Story in Yiddish and Polish Literature. And towards the beginning, he writes what I brought here. My purpose is not to examine the authenticity of this tradition, which is established for our purpose by virtue of its currency in both Polish and Yiddish literature. But to He says, if this story were made up by the Poles, you'd find it in Polish literature. If it were made up by the Jews, you'd find it in Jewish literature. He says, you find parallel strands in the different literatures, and he argues that that in and of itself is sufficient to authenticate the story. At the same time, the lack of any report from the time of King Casimir himself, the use of the name Esther, and the fact that this fellow Dlugosz and his heirs in the Polish stream of literature have an awful lot to gain with this story suggests that, no, this was likely urban legend that somebody decided to write up and pass on as though it were true. Because there is a lot going on in this story. It's much more than there was a woman and she was Jewish and he fell for her and he decided to help her people. If you take a look at source number 17, Professor Byron Sherwin wrote a book called Sparks Amidst the Ashes, talking about Polish-Jewish literature. And regarding this, he says, scholars interpret the legend of Casimir and Esterka as it has been developed and retold over the centuries as a lens refracting various visions of the place of the Jews in Poland throughout Polish history. How the legend is told may reveal more about the teller than about the legend itself. And he hits it on the nose. It's all in how you tell the story. Poles often saw this story as representing the worst traits of the Jews. Right? How would you do that? Looking at this story, right, recognizing we have about 4 minutes. But what would you do with this story if you wanted to use it in a negative way? Right, Linda says the Jews were manipulative, the Jews were immoral. Right. The rights they were given were illegitimate. Sorry, Eddie?
They infiltrated.
It's a way to delegitimize the rights that have been given to the Jews. And Dlugosz is somebody who really doesn't like Jews. We're going to have to hit that next time, but it's what you can already see what I brought you in 18 and 19. If you take a look ahead, you'll see it there. But he's really not in our fan club. But just to summarize what we've seen, we started out by seeing sources which present for us two different views of Polish-Jewish relations. You have the Poles who say, paradise for the Jews, and you have Agnon saying, we paid for it. You have Casimir the Great, who comes into a Poland that is depopulated, that has shrunken, that has battles with people on the outside, and he makes treaties, fights to gain additional territory, brings people in to populate the land, including Jews, builds up the towns, stone instead of wood, systems of administration, builds up a university, works on the currency, trying to create a stronger Poland. And he takes the rights that had been given to Jews before his time, affirms them, the ones from Boleslav II, and adds to them and expands them in his own day. It could be interpreted as something that he does because it supports his agenda in the country. It could be because it provides him with wealth. But there's an allegation that it's because of this woman, Esterka, who was his mistress, fitting in with his general tumultuous family life. And what we're going to see, God willing, next time before we get into Napoleon, will be a discussion of two different ways to view this story. The Polish version of it, and the version that was suggested in some Jewish quarters, as well as how this has impacted the way that Poles and Israelis look at the relationship today, including this year's issue with Netanyahu and the leadership in Poland. And then we'll move on from that, God willing, to talk about Napoleon and his relationship with the Jews, which is fascinating in its own right. So be back here, please, next week. Thank you very much.